Welcome to the Northeast Christian Podcast. We're so excited that you've decided to check out our weekly messages. We hope that you're challenged and inspired by what you're hearing today. We'd love to have you join us this weekend at one of our campuses or online at northeast.live. For more information on Northeast, visit us at necchurch.org. If you love the Northeast Podcast, subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment or a rating in the Apple Podcast Store. This weekend's message is from Tyler McKenzie. He's the lead pastor here at Northeast.
Well, hey, good morning. Before we get down to business, quick shout out to everyone in our online audience. Welcome, Kim, who came to our 9 a.m. service and wanted to watch again. I'm really not sure why, but Kim, you're awesome. Welcome back. Welcome, Miranda, who's in the Peace Corps down in the Caribbean Islands. Every single week she joins us, and she always invites some of her friends to come along too. Welcome, Lillian, sweet Lillian, one of my favorite three-year-olds in the world in Alabama. Welcome, everybody. Welcome people from all around the Ville, from LaGrange to Portland, across the toll bridges down 65. We'd love to have you here in person next week. Welcome Lexington, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Springfield, Bowling Green, Chicago, Toledo, Cleveland, Columbus, Denver, LA, Miami, Atlanta, Houston, and over 20 states. Welcome India. Welcome Santiago, Chile. I bet you that's Greg and Ellie. Hey, class. Welcome Dubai. Welcome one. Welcome all. We are so glad you've decided to join us today. And welcome to everybody in the room. We're especially glad to see your smiling faces in the room. So as you guys probably know, today we are launching into the fourth and the final installment of a two-season, eight-week sermon series that we've been doing called Let's Talk About Mental Health that started all the way back in October with season one. We've just found that this series in particular has been so well engaged and so impactful, and so we decided to come back and do a round two just a few months after round one. I think the reason why it's been so, impactful is because it's so personal. It's so practical. It's in the trenches of your everyday life. I say this statistic at the beginning of every sermon, but I just want this to sink in on you. One out of five, at the very least at any given time, one out of five Americans are dealing with a mental health struggle. One out of five, which means that five out of five of us know someone and love someone dealing with a mental health problem. It's in your homes, it's in your workplaces, it's in your schools, it's among your kids, it's in our church, it's sitting in this room right now. And so we just knew that we had to talk about it. Now, in the first season of the series back in October, we talked specifically to the one out of five of us in this room who are struggling. This season, we kind of switched the focus a little bit, and we're speaking directly at all the five out of five of us in this room who love and care for someone who's struggling. The goal of this series has been to help caregivers care better, to help everyone in this room answer the question, how do I help someone who's struggling with something that I've never struggled with before, and honestly, I have a hard time understanding and empathizing with? Okay, if that's you, the series is for you. Now, we've done that by laying out three, today you'll get the four power principles that will help caregivers care better. In week one, we talked about growing in empathy. Steve did a great job with that. Week two, we talked about choosing the truth, because the truth will set you free. Last week, we talked about practicing selfless self-leadership, which I know sounds kind of counterintuitive, but trust me on this one. If you missed last week, you need to go back and catch up on last week, because it'll be for you no matter where you're at in life. Today, I want to challenge you with the fourth power principle. I want to challenge you with hope. In fact, specifically, I want to challenge you to be the hope. Now, before I get too deep in the challenge, though, I feel like we need to establish like a baseline, ground-level definition of hope. Because hope is one of those fuzzy, religious, Christian words that everybody says, I have hope. But nobody knows what they're actually talking about when they say it. So let's just make sure we're all talking about the same thing when I say hope. Here's what hope is. Pretty simple. Hope is a belief that what I want can become what I have. Pretty simple. Now, this is important, though, so repeat that after me. Say, hope is a belief that what I want can become what I have. It's that simple. I don't have it yet, but I believe that somehow, some way, someday, this thing that I want, this better preferred future, can actually become my present, can become my reality, my today, if I progress towards it. That's what hope is. Now, if you have ever experienced this belief before, hope, then you know how powerful this belief right here is. Man, is it powerful. We saved hope for last because we actually believed we were saving the best for last. Because I believe there is nothing out there available to you more powerful to empower you to overcome any obstacle in life, mental health or something else, doesn't matter, any obstacle in life other than hope. It is just that powerful. I mean, have you not seen hope work? Because I have. Over the last year in my life, I've seen hope empower someone to lose 100 pounds. I've seen hope empower underdogs to take down Goliaths against, you know, overwhelming odds. I've seen hope empower people to break addictions that were years old. I've seen hope empower people to overcome anxiety, depression, eating disorders, suicide. I've seen hope empower parents to get through the loss of a child. I've seen hope empower more than one person to face down death itself as death swallowed them up. And that is a very, very powerful force. It's a powerful belief. One psychologist, when talking about hope and mental health, wrote this. I thought it was pretty fascinating. He said, if I could find a way to package and dispense hope, I would have a pill more powerful than any antidepressant on the market. And I do believe that it is that powerful. And here's the better news. I believe that you can actually package and dispense hope. You can, if you want hope today, you can have hope. If you want hope today, you could walk out of this room with hope in your head and hope in your heart. If you want to give hope to someone else, you can walk out of this room today with the capacity and capability to spark it in the lives of those around you, if you actually want it. And it's really not that difficult. It's not that complex. It's pretty simple, and it's very powerful. And who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want hope in them and the ability to give hope to those around them? I think you do. I do. So look, for those of us in here who want to spark hope, if you want to be hope igniters, again, here's what you have to remember. Hope is a belief, or at least it begins as a belief in someone's head. So in order to spark hope, you have to convince them of a belief. That's what you're doing, right? And to convince anyone of any belief, well, what you're gonna need is you're gonna need convincing words, convincing strategies, convincing plans, convincing success stories. You're gonna need a convincing vision for them. But if you wanna sustain hope over time, you're gonna need more than just convincing words and convincing vision. Convincing words and vision spark it, but sustaining it is something entirely different. See, that's why I believe that there are two key ingredients when it comes to hope. Two. There's possibility and progress. Possibility and progress. Possibility sparks hope because you make someone believe in the possibility of what could be, of what should be, a healthier, happier, whole version of themselves. But that possibility is not what sustains hope over time. No, if hope is going to sustain and if hope is going to grow, then they're gonna need to see progress towards that hope. What causes people to lose hope? You ever seen somebody lose hope before? What causes that? For someone to slide from hope into hopelessness? It's a lack of progress. It's a lack of progress. So much so that they stop believing in the possibility. So you need both. I had a friend who went through a debilitating season of depression recently. It was so dark, it got so bad that she began to consider suicide. She had a plan even. And so her husband and my wife and myself, we just decided it's now or never. We have to step up in her life and we gotta spark hope. And so we did. We cast vision for her future. We told her who she could be, who she should be. We pointed to a healthier, happy version of her that could be her future. And it did spark hope. Now, I'm not sure if this vision for her future actually was what sparked hope inside of her. I'm not sure if she even believed that she could ever get better. But what she did believe is that we believed she could get better. And that was enough to spark hope initially. Now, after we kind of sparked this in her life, we didn't just kind of drop a hope grenade and say, you can get better, and good luck with that. See ya, you know, and bounce out. No, because that's not what hope looks like. Or at least that's not what would sustain and grow hope. No, we stuck around. And we invested. We leaned in. First, we diagnosed the problem. And then we came up with solutions. And here was the problem. Her depression was just lying to her. It was lying to her. It was lying to her about who she was. It was lying to her about what her friends and family thought about her. It was lying to her about her future. It was just lying day in and day out. So we said, okay, here's the solution. Day in and day out, we're just gonna meet these lies with the truth. We're gonna have truth-telling sessions, and they're not gonna be nice. They're not gonna be easy. We're not always gonna be gracious. We're just gonna go head on. Here's the lie. Well, here's the counterpoint. Here's the truth to that lie. And we did. There were group text messages, late night conversations, coffee dates, just every single day. We met lie with truth, lie with truth, lie with truth. And guess what happened? Day after day, slowly but surely, this spark of hope turned into a flame. And this flame turned into a wildfire. Hope picked up momentum, it grew, and eventually hope prevailed in her life. Because that's how hope works. So maybe I could say it to you like this. You know what hope isn't? Hope isn't just something that we know. It's also something that we grow. Hope isn't just believing. No, it has to be living in you. We have to cultivate and become a living hope. And at the end of the day, that's what you want anyways. You don't want just a belief, do you? No, you want better. You want change. You want forward toward that better reality, that better future. You want what you want to become what you have, right? Because that's what hope is. But that takes more than just a state of mind. That's a way of life. Hope has to come to life. Now, I'll tell you a couple stories about hope today. And here's the interesting thing about these stories. That you've heard them before. Most of you have heard these stories. These will not be new stories for you. But you've never heard them probably used in the context of someone explaining hope. But I think these are such great hope stories. And they help illustrate exactly how hope works. Because hope works. The first story is a story of 40 years of unfulfilled hope. It begins with a leader named Joshua. And you've probably heard of Joshua, but Joshua steps into his leadership role having to succeed a living legend. Like the most famous, the most celebrated, the most accomplished leader in the history of the people of God, Moses. You guys know Moses? I'm talking about like the Moses. Moses, you know, let my people go. Pharaoh, Moses, prince of Egypt, Moses, like that. Okay, so I'll tell you a story. So the Israelites had been in Egyptian slavery for hundreds of years, and they had all but lost hope. So Moses, sent by God, comes in, and he sparks hope by pointing to the possibility of a promised land. He says, you are still God's chosen people. He has not forgotten about you. And guess what? He is about to lead us up out of Egypt into the wilderness and into the promised land. That's our hope. Now, when the people of Israel heard this, it did spark hope. I mean, it gave them this vision of what was possible. But there was still this whole problem of like Pharaoh and his army, the military superpower of the world at that time. Ain't no way they're gonna let their slave labor force just walk out of Egypt. But Moses said, all right, you know, I can talk the talk, but watch me walk the walk. Watch me now. And 10 plagues and a Red Sea parting later, the Israelite people walked out into the wilderness toward the promised land. Now, I'll tell you what, after seeing Moses and God work through Moses in such a powerful way, their little spark of hope turned into a flame, a wildfire again. Exodus chapter 14, it says that when the people of Israel saw the mighty power the Lord had unleashed against the Egyptians, they were filled with awe before him. They put their faith in the Lord and in his servant, Moses. Now, why were they filled with such awe? Why were they so ready to put their faith in him? Why? Well, because possibility showed some progress. some significant progress. And so hope exploded. Now, here's the only problem with Israel, though. They're just like you. And they're just like me. They are a difficult people. And so anytime their progress stalled, even just a little bit, they became disobedient. In fact, sometimes when their progress didn't stall, they still became disobedient. They just woke up that way, just like you and just like me. And so, because of that, they were punished by having to wander through the wilderness for 40 years. 40 years of unfulfilled hope. And to add insult to injury, at the end of that 40 years, Moses died. Talk about a death blow to their hope. But then Joshua emerged as the new leader, and he was anointed by God. This is what God said. Joshua chapter 1, verse 6. God said, Moses is dead, Joshua, but be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. For you are the one who will lead these people to possess all the land, the promised land, all the land I swore to their ancestors that I would give them. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that right there was the hope of Israel, the promised land, to be a blessing to the nations. And that right there was a hope of Joshua's, to be the leader who would lead God's people into the promised land. But here's what Joshua realized. If that hope was to be realized, it could not just be a belief, because hope is more than just believing, it's living. Hope is more than just knowing, it's growing. Hope isn't just a state of mind, it's a way of life. And so he would have to bring hope to life. So immediately he gets to work. Joshua 1, he receives this promise, and Joshua 2, he sends two spies out into the promised land to scope it out, specifically to scope out the city of Jericho, because it was the first strategic site just across the Jordan River in the promised land that they knew they would have to take. Joshua chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "And Joshua secretly sent out two spies from the Israelite camp at Acacia Grove. He instructed them, scout out the land on the other side of the Jordan River, especially around Jericho," that's the place. "And so the two men set out, and they came to the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there that night." And immediately, we see why the Israelite people wandered through the desert for 40 years. Because these dudes have been out of Joshua's sight for about 2 minutes, and where do they end up? In the house, okay, well, anyways, I mean, like, honestly, there were other houses in Jericho, trust me. Oh, Joshua, we didn't know. Sure, right? But, I mean, this is what I love about the Bible, y'all. It gives you a picture of their leaders, flaws, and all. So, while the two spies are scouting and doing God knows what else, Joshua's back at the camp with the Israelites, getting the work done and getting ready. So they walk, Joshua 3 and 4, read these chapters, it's amazing. They walk across the Jordan River onto dry ground into the promised land. And as soon as they step into the promised land, Joshua is given his first leadership assignment in the promised land. It's an interesting one. Joshua chapter 5, verse 2. It says, "At that time, the Lord told Joshua, hey, make flint knives and circumcise the second generation of Israelites." So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the entire male population of Israel. Now, translation. Joshua's first leadership assignment was to perform outpatient surgery on all the men, young and old, in his church. And if you ever want to see me tender my resignation as the leader of this church, God won't even have to call me to snippy all of y'all. It's just gonna be one of y'all. And I'll say, "God, that's not what I'm called to." Can you imagine being Joshua walking across the Jordan River and then having to cast vision for this? "All right, boys, everybody get in line." You know, it's gonna hurt me more than it hurts you. Okay, sort of. My wife last night said, hashtag snip the veil. Okay. Now, while Josh was doing his thing, finally the spies come back. And the spies are like, "What is going on?" And Josh was like, "Get in line." But then he gets the intel that he needs. And then the Lord sends them to go take Jericho. And here was God's strategy that he gave Joshua. Joshua chapter 6. says, now the gates of Jericho were tightly shut because the people were afraid of the Israelites. No one was allowed to go out or in. But the Lord said to Joshua, I have given you Jericho, its king and all its strong warriors. So here's your strategy. I want you and your fighting men to march around the town once a day for 6 days. 7 priests will walk ahead of the ark, each carrying a ram's horn. And on the 7th day, you're to march around the town 7 times with the priests blowing the horns. And when you hear the priests give one long blast on the ram's horns, have all the people shout as loud as they can. And then the walls of the town will collapse and the people can charge straight into the town. Now, if you're reading this for the first time or for the 100th time, this may sound like a pretty mundane verse to you. It's just the strategy, right? But if you've ever been in the military before, then immediately what jumps out at you is how stupid of a strategy this is. With all due respect to God, he can do what he wants to, right? But if you're a military tactician, what in the, can you imagine? Again, the boys are still hurting and sore from the whole, and Joshua calls his generals together. And he's like, strategy meeting, generals, come together. Which, by the way, how could you ever look your friend in the eye after, okay, sorry. But he's, generals, come together. He said, all right, strategy meeting. God has given us a strategy of how we're going to take the promised land. And here's how we're going to do it. Yeah, see that hand in the back? Go ahead, Mr. General. I know how we're going to do it. He's going to send plagues again, like in Egypt. And there's going to be like locusts, and there's going to be, you know, blood water and a destroyer angel. And Joshua says, that was cool when God did that, but that's not the strategy this time. Yeah, see that hand in the back? Go ahead right there, Mr. General. Yeah, I know how he's going to do it. No. This is what he's going to do. Like he parted the Red Sea, he's going to part the ground underneath Jericho. And they're going to fall through and just, and the earth's going to suck them up. It's going to come back together. And we're going to be able to walk in to the promised land. And Joshua says, that was cool when God did the whole Red Sea and, you know, pummeled the Egyptians. But that's not the strategy this time either. No, here's what God told me we're going to do, boys. We're going to get in a straight line. And they're all like, oh, no, not this again. No, it's a different line. We're gonna get in line. And we're going to walk a circle around Jericho. Then we're going to come home and eat dinner and go to bed. And then on the 2nd day, we're going to get in a line. And we're going to walk a circle around Jericho. And then we're going to come home and eat dinner and go to bed. And then on the 3rd and the 4th and the 5th and the 6th and the 7th day, we're going to get in a line. And we're going to walk circles around Jericho. Yeah, see that hand in the back? Go ahead, General number 3. Yeah, so this is not a very good strategy, Joshua. Yeah, I know, it's God's strategy. All due respect, God. So here's one way we can make it maybe a little bit better. You know what we should do? In the front of the line, we should put like all of our special ops dudes, all the warriors that are just yoked, all the heavy weaponry and artillery. And Joshua says, no, that's not actually what we're going to do either. No, in the front of the line, we're going to put the priests, the preachers and the worship leaders in their plaid and skinny jeans, because that'll scare them, right? Now, I'm getting sidetracked, okay? It's just like, these are interesting. You should read your Bible because it's interesting and sometimes confusing, but very interesting. But like, what's the point of this story? Well, here's the point. Joshua does it. He does it. And they take Jericho. And for the first time in 40 years, hope was fulfilled. Hope was realized. They had taken a significant sliver of the promised land. And shortly after, they would take the rest of it. Now, what in the world did Joshua and can we learn from this sort of crazy story? Well, I'll tell you what I think we can learn. If you want to see the promised land, you have to take it. You got to take it. And if you want to see the promised land, you are actually inviting God in his mysterious, sometimes confusing, sometimes seemingly irrational ways, but you are actually inviting God to assign you work, because that's how hope works. Hope works. And if you ever want hope to work, hope better get to work. But the promised land wasn't cheap, y'all. It was costly, and it was risky, and it was messy, and it took a long, long time to take, over 40 years. And the pathway there was full of unconventional strategies and irrational methods and hard-fought battles and a whole lot of wondering and three steps forward, two steps back. But at the end of the day, hope was realized because Joshua realized that hope gets to work. And so I just want to challenge everyone in here today. If you want hope to work, then get to work. Get to work, because that's how hope works. So let me be really clear here, okay? Just can we talk last 10%? We'd like to go last 10% here. Here's what hope isn't. And we talked about this last week. I just want to be even clearer this week. This is what hope isn't. Hope isn't wishful thinking. That's not hope. I hope you'll get better. I hope things will turn around for you. Okay, sounds nice. It sounds nice, but it does nothing. And that's not what hope looks like. You know what wishful thinking is? Wishful thinking is depending on chance. Wishful thinking is depending on luck. Wishful thinking is depending on some sort of random, magical thing to just happen. It's depending on magic. And are there any magicians in here right now? I didn't think so. You see, I don't trust chance and I don't trust luck. Don't know about you. I bet you don't either. In any arena of your life. I mean, could you imagine being an investor and, some business leader coming to you and saying, all right, here's the business plan I want you to invest in right here. Okay, you ready for this? Every single year, we're just gonna depend on luck. We're just gonna hope Lady Luck looks our way. So all you investors on this side of the table, we'll send some rabbit's feet around to you. All you on this side of the table, here comes some four-leaf clovers, and nobody step on any cracks on the way out. Now, if they pitched to you that plan, here's what you would do. You'd laugh. Okay, you'd laugh, and then you'd say, what's the real plan? Because luck is not a real plan. But that's what wishful thinking is. Okay, let's say you went to the doctor and you were pretty certain that you were very sick. And the doctor came to you and said, all right, here's the deal. This is a quarter. You see this quarter? Okay, it's a quarter. And heads, we do the blood test. Tails, we'll just chance it. Now, what are you gonna do next? Heads or tails, you're gonna get a second opinion, right? Because you are not, even for a second, going to put your life in the hands of chance. And yet that's what wishful thinking is. It's just putting your life in the hands of chance. Okay, you know what wishful thinking is a strategy for? Wishful thinking. And it sounds good. I hope you'll get better. But it does no good. So here's another story for you. And this is what hope looks like. In Luke chapter 5, the scriptures tell us that Jesus' teaching and healing ministry was gathering big crowds around him. Pick up in verse 17. It says, one day, while Jesus was teaching and the Lord's healing power was strongly with him, some men came carrying a paralyzed man on a sleeping mat. They tried to take him inside of Jesus, but they couldn't reach him because there was a crowd, right? So they went up to the roof, and they took off some tiles. And back then, roofs were made of like mud, and also they basically would have to dig through it. So they took off some tiles, and they lowered the sick man on his mat down into the crowd, right in front of Jesus. And what are those next three words? Seeing their faith. Those are important words. Will you repeat that after me? Say, seeing their faith. Seeing their faith, Jesus said to the man, young man, your sins are forgiven. Stand up, pick up your mat, and go home. And he did. He did. Now, that is what hope looks like, right there. That's living hope. That's not just believing, that's living. That's just not knowing what you want, that's growing what you want. That's not just a state of mind, that's a way of life, bringing hope to life. I mean, you see what these friends did? See what? Okay, obstacle number one. There's a healer in town, but our buddy's paralyzed. He can't walk, so what are we going to do? All right, you take that leg, I'll take this arm, and here we go. Off we go to the healer. Obstacle number two. There's a huge crowd around him, so we can't get to him. So, okay, I got an idea. One, two, three, up you go, and we're on top of the roof. Obstacle number three. There's a roof on top of the roof, so let's dig a hole. Dig a hole. And then obstacle number four, it's going to be about an 8 to 9 foot drop, but hey, he's a healer. One, two, three, and there he is in front of Jesus. But immediately when he lands in front of Jesus, what does it say? It says, seeing their faith, seeing their faith. Jesus forgives and heals the man. What was so impressive about their faith? It's the fact that it wasn't just a belief, right? It wasn't just a belief. No, they had unrelenting, roof-wrecking, ain't nothing gonna stop us. We'll drag our friend to the feet of Jesus if we got to faith. Hope. They wanted a miracle, but they did not wait on a miracle. They made the miracle happen. And that's what hope is. So if you're kind of the person who just kind of leans into wishful thinking and says to your friends and your loved ones, hey, I hope things will turn around for you. I hope things will get better. Would you do me a favor and just stop using hope's name in vain? Because that is not hope. Instead, just be honest. Just tell your friend, hey, I'm thinking about you. I really am. I'm thinking about you, but I'm not going to do anything for you. I'm thinking about this, but I'm not going to do anything about this. I'm just going to depend on chance and hope Lady Luck looks our way. Because that's what wishful thinking is. But that certainly is not what hope is. Okay, let's go a little bit further. You know what else hope is not? And this may ruffle some feathers in here, but hey, it's good for us. Okay, hope is not just thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers coming your way. I'm praying for you, brother. Thoughts and prayers, sister. Okay, you know what my non-Christian friends say? And I'm always like, this is even weirder than prayer. What do you mean? But they're like positive vibes. I'm sending you positive vibes. I'm like, okay, prayer's really confusing to me. But I always ask my friends, I'm like, how does that work? Tell me how to, positive vibes, positive. Anyways, so it's all confusing. Prayer, thoughts, positive vibes, it's all kind of like confusing. But here's what's not confusing. What's not confusing is that just thoughts and prayers and positive, it's not hope. That's not hope. It's not hope. You see, I believe in the power of prayer. Don't get me wrong. I do. But I believe that most often, what makes prayer so powerful is that it provokes us to action. It synergizes us and energizes us around the will of God so that we might go and make that happen. You see, if you're praying for something but unwilling to act on it, you know what you're actually praying for? You're praying for a miracle. And that's okay because miracles happen sometimes. But miracles are miracles. They are not the norm. Okay, if miracles were the norm, they wouldn't be called miracles, they'd be called normals. And thank you for a few people finally laughing at that joke. That was my favorite part of the sermon, 9 a.m. crickets. Anyways, so you guys are more sophisticated. Okay, for those of you who didn't laugh and don't agree with me, James, the brother of Jesus, does. This is what he says. The brother of Jesus says, suppose, okay, just imagine with me for a second. Suppose you see a brother or sister who has no food or clothing, okay? You got it? Now, then you suppose you then say to that person, goodbye, and have a good day. Stay warm and eat well. Thoughts and prayers coming your way, sending you some positive vibes. I'm sending you some positive vibes for some food and some clothing. See you later. But then you don't give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do? And what an obvious question. It's a rhetorical question, but it's the obvious one. What good? What good does that do? So you see, the brother of Jesus says, faith by itself isn't enough. Unless it produces good deeds, it's dead and useless. So translation, James says, don't just send your thoughts and your prayers and your positive vibes, okay? If you really care, send food and clothes. Because that's how hope works. That's how faith works. So maybe I can say it to you like this today, y'all. Okay, you know why God created the church? God didn't create the church for us to just sit back and wait for a miracle. No. He created the church for us to be the miracle. He didn't create the church for us to just sit back and wait on heaven. No. He created the church for us to pull heaven down, to make God's kingdom come and his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. He created us like his son Jesus to be the living hope. So what are we waiting for? Be the hope. For those of you who have a loved one struggling with mental health, and you want to spark and sustain hope in their lives, let me just give you a few practical ideas. Because it is your calling. I believe it is your calling to be the hope in their life. At first, knowledge. Knowledge sparks and sustains hope. And by knowledge, I mean educating yourself. When you and your loved one who is struggling educate yourself on their mental illness, what you do is you turn something that's kind of mystical and fuzzy into a medical diagnosis that has treatment plans and explanations and success stories. And you know what treatment plans, explanations, and success stories do? They spark hope. And then they give you pathways to sustain hope and grow it. Supportive community sparks and sustains hope. When you surround yourself with supportive community, not only is there just something therapeutic about being able to talk to someone with shared experience, but usually there's someone in that community that's like two or three steps ahead of you. And so psychologists say when you see that person who's just a few steps ahead of you, it suspends disbelief in your mind. What does that mean? It means you look at them and you think, well, if he can do it, and have you seen him? I mean, come on, he's kind of rough. So if he can do it, then I can do it. Finding purpose and pain sparks and sustains hope. That's why I believe you should just forget about any of the stigmas that come with mental health, and you should share your story, share your story, share your story with others. Because every time you share your story, there's a chance that it might touch someone else and inspire someone else and uplift someone else. And if you can help someone else, then all of a sudden your pain has a little bit of purpose. All of a sudden that suffering that you and your family went through wasn't for nothing. Remembering sparks and sustains hope. I have a friend who counsels veterans who go through PTSD. And she says she practices this and she makes her patients practice this. They create what I would call hope memorials, hope holidays. Anytime one of her patients has like a breakthrough moment, or they have this season of great progress, or you know, like they overcome some sort of great darkness in their life, she says, write that down, and we'll come back and celebrate that in a month. We're gonna celebrate this holiday, this day, next year. Because see, what happens is you'll make progress, but then time will pass, and all of a sudden you'll find yourself in a bad place again, and you'll begin to lose hope that you can make progress. But one thing that can spark that hope again is to look back and remember how you overcame that, or remember that season and what you did when you overcame all that. It can create this possibility, this renewed breath of life inside of you. Being there sparks and sustains hope. Because you see, when you're in the midst of a mental health struggle, it can be dark and lonely. But just having someone standing next to you under the burden make things a little less dark and a little less lonely. Oh, and last, Christians, come on. Jesus followers, come on. Isn't it true? Heaven. Our hope in heaven, our ultimate hope, sparks and sustains hope. See, you know what we Christians believe? We believe that a time is coming, a day is coming where mental health struggles will be no more. Wow. In fact, we believe that 2 billion, 10 billion, 100 billion years from now, when we are in heaven and we're starting to get sick of each other, all these momentary struggles will be memorials to your faithfulness there. Revelation chapter 21, verse 3, John writes this about our hope in heaven. This is what it'll look like. I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, look, God's home is now among his people, and he will be with them, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them. And he will wipe every tear from their eyes. and there will be no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain. All these things are gone forever. What a hope we have. That is our ultimate hope. And that is a living hope. A hope about the future that can and should change who you are in the present. It's a closing challenge for you. All right, I'm gonna give you this challenge. Last 10%, one more time. If you are here today and you are praying and begging God to help someone that you love, but you are unwilling to act and be the hope, you know what you're really praying for? You know what you're really praying for? You're praying for someone else. You're praying for someone else to come and love your neighbor for you. But here's the only problem with that. God didn't call anyone else to love your neighbor for you. God didn't call someone else to bear the burden of your brother or your sister. He didn't call someone else to be the miracle or to be the answer to their prayer. No, he called the church to, and you are the church. We say it like this around here. Jesus is the hope of the world. You better believe it. We believe it. He is. But the church is his body in the world. That's why this vision for a Love the Ville lifestyle in every single last one of us and collectively as a whole is so important. We want to redefine church around the love of Jesus. We want to earn for ourselves that sort of cross-shaped, self-sacrificial, loving, caring, compassionate, I will walk the line, I will die for you. You know, that we want to earn that reputation here. Because we're the body of Jesus. He has no other face other than our faces. He has no other hands other than our hands, no other mouth and words other than our mouths and our words. He has no other head and mind and body and heart other than our minds and our hearts. No other care and compassion and creativity other than our care, compassion, and creativity. He has no other love other than our love. So if we want to prove to the world that God is alive and he is love and he can still bring dead things back to life, then we got to get to work. Because hope works. The church is God's plan A. There is no plan B. And we're the church. We're the church. We're the church. So go and be the church. Go and bear the burdens. Go and be the miracle. Go and be the answered prayer. Hope for the impossible, but don't wait on it. Pray for the miracle, but don't expect it. Be it. Because we're the body of Jesus. And what's true of Jesus should be true of us. So go and be the church. Go and be Jesus. Because if Jesus is the hope of the world, then we are the hope of the world. Heavenly Father, I pray that you would spark inside of every hopeless heart in this room a hope in you today. A hope maybe just in this extension of you, our church, that we could be that sort of supportive community that can help them begin to make progress toward the possibility of healing. I pray especially though for every person in this room that you would spark inside of them a living hope, that we could be beacons of hope, that people would see inside of us that sort of unrelenting, roof-wrecking, ain't nothing gonna stop us, we'll just drag our friends if we got to the feet of Jesus sort of faith. Sort of hope, that we bring hope to life in this place. And in so doing, we just become this beacon of healing for our community, that they look to us. And not just our community, but churches all over the country, people all over the world look to us. And they see in us exactly what hope looks like, exactly what Jesus looks like. God, we are difficult people, so send the Holy Spirit to help. Because it's hard to do it alone. It's in Jesus' powerful name we pray. Amen. Hey, as you guys probably know, this past December, this Love the Ville church raised over $1 million to Love the Ville. Part of that's going to mental health solutions for our city. But if you want to know where we're investing all that and how we're investing all of that, we have a special opportunity next week during the sermon time. So I want to encourage you, online audience, people, be here next week so you can hear what's going on in, for the future of our Loveville outreach projects this year. All right, thank you for being here today. If you're a guest, we'd love to meet you right out at the guest relations kiosk in the lobby. And if you need prayer or you want to talk to someone about hope, do not leave. Walk through those doors right there and go to the fireside room. A pastor will be there ready to meet you. God bless you guys. Go be the hope.